This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on October 29th, 2015. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
So we will move to the next item on the agenda. Item 4, Draft Advisory Opinion 2015-9, Senate Majority PAC and House Majority PAC. Today we have Theo Lutz and Amy Rothstein from OGC here to discuss the matter, and we also have Mark Elias, welcome, and Jonathan Burkon and Rachel Jacobs. If you'd like, you could pull up a chair, whatever your preference is here. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. This one? All right, I've been told to use the left mic.
Oh, right. I don't think the other one works.
Okay.
Thank you. Is there a presentation from staff? Thank you. Mr. Lutz.
Thank you. Agenda documents 15, 57A, and 57B are draft responses to an advisory opinion request by Senate Majority PAC and House Majority PAC. The requesters are independent expenditure-only political committees, otherwise known as super PACs, who support Democratic candidates in U.S. Senate and House races. The requesters ask 12 questions about their proposed activities, which involve individuals contemplating federal candidacy, individuals who are federal candidates, and other super PACs. Both drafts conclude that some of the proposed activities would be permissible under the Act, and others would be impermissible under the Act. Draft B also concludes that the Commission is unable to answer questions 11 and 12. At the time that the meeting began, the Commission had received 5 comments on the AOR and the drafts. And if the Commission approves a draft, we request authority to make technical and conforming changes.
Thank you. Are there any questions of either counsel or Mr. Elias? Commissioners? Any discussion? Any discussion?
I'll start off with a question that I
that's been
on my
question.
Mind.
Right,
and
please.
But it's a legal question. It's not so much about the request, but since you're the requester, Mr. Elias,
I'm a lawyer.
Excuse me, the lawyer for the requester.
Thank you.
One of the issues knocking around in all these questions is before an individual becomes a candidate, the meets and bounds of this commission's jurisdiction to regulate at all. And the fact that even testing the waters expenditures are extra statutory. They are created by regulation. And so I guess I would just like your studied opinion as a practitioner in this field for a long time, and I know has given a lot of thought to this. When you look at GOPAC, when you look at Machinist League, when you look at the draft Kennedy cases, all those court decisions say that prior to being a candidate, this commission doesn't have jurisdiction over the individual. Now, by regulation, we've asserted some retroactive jurisdiction for testing the waters. And we only assert that jurisdiction if you become a candidate later. If you don't become a candidate, you never even have to report those testing the waters expenditures. So could you, one of your questions asked about the triggering of candidacy. So that's a little bit different. But for all these activities before somebody becomes a candidate, where are the meets and bounds of our jurisdiction?
So first, I would just make a slight correction. There are a number of questions that I think we ask that don't rest on pre-candidacy. We ask a question about the definition of an event. We ask a question about the scope of agency, both of which don't have anything to do with triggering candidacy. We ask questions about activity by a super PAC when there is a candidate and the kinds of activity they engage in. But I don't want people who have not read all of the various drafts and requests to think that
many of your questions implicate this question. Could you just help me think through the meets and bounds?
Yeah. So I didn't mean that as anything other than a clarification, so that people don't think that the request was just on those questions. So to answer your question directly, I would say two things. The first is that, for purposes of the advisory opinion request and the advisory opinion process, I don't think this process does anything other than operates within the regulations lawfully promulgated by the commission. So I'm going to answer your, I promise I'm going to answer your question about my thoughts, but I think procedurally, the commission has enacted a regulation or promulgated a regulation. That regulation, I don't believe, has ever been challenged in court. And an advisory opinion is not the process by which one would challenge that regulation. So I think in some sense, the scope of your jurisdiction in the advisory opinion context is the application of the statute and the regulations. Now I understand your point would be, well, what if the statute and the regulations aren't harmonious? And in fact, I'm looking at Commissioner Hunter, because we had a similar discussion way back when around a recount advisory opinion, where I think, and I don't want to characterize your position, you asked a similar question of, well, doesn't the statute not cover, isn't all of this exempt? Aren't the rules that you're asking for under this AO essentially outside, isn't the agency asserting a jurisdiction in something that in fact the agency has no jurisdiction? So I'll give you a similar first answer, which is that may or may not be true, but in the advisory opinion context, I'm here with the regulations I have and the statute I have, and I'm asking an advisory opinion under those regs and that statute. So those two long preambles to your question, I have not given an enormous amount of thought to this question, because I think that the question of what you do with conduct that is testing the waters, that is and how you regulate or don't regulate testing the waters activities, is a distinct question from what do you do with activity that is in fact candidacy activity that is simply done before people file paperwork with the FEC. So in other words, the fact that you have not yet declared candidacy doesn't mean you're testing the waters. And the fact that you are, so what would you do if you had a campaign that, or not a campaign, you had a person who was genuinely uncertain as to whether to run and wanted to take a poll or do some preliminary testing the waters activities, and what if, for example, they use corporate resources to do it, or they made the fundraising, the initial sort of political outreach calls, out of their corporate office, I think presents one set of questions. I think it is a different set of questions if that person has decided they are going to run for office. They simply don't yet want to have triggered the requirements of the Federal Election Campaign Act, so they don't declare candidacy. So I think that that's one distinction. The second distinction is that I think that at the heart of this request, in some questions, is not whether the activity was lawful. Now, this is not, some questions do go to the lawfulness of activity pre-candidacy, as we propose engaging in it with prospective potential candidates. But part of what House Majority PAC and Senate Majority PAC want to know is, if we engage in activity with people who are not yet candidates, right? We essentially go to them and say, look, you are not yet a candidate, you may not have made a final decision yet whether to run, but as an insurance policy, in case you're going to run, why don't we shoot footage of you now with you talking to camera about the issues that you would run on, right? These are the things, you may still not be a candidate, but you are providing us a vault of information and footage and other things that would allow us to more effectively run independent expenditures for you. I think that's within the jurisdiction of the Act. Now, whether or not the advisory opinion should come out one way or the other, I think it is within the jurisdiction of the Commission to determine whether that activity that is going to take place when someone is a candidate is or is not covered by 109.21. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, Commissioner.
if I am considering running for office, and I come to you, a super PAC, because in testing the waters, of course, I'm looking for support, right?
Right.
I'm going to any number of interest groups saying, if I thought I had sufficient support, it might tip my decision to decide to run, and you're one of those, would I have your support? But I'm testing the waters, okay? And we agree that while I'm here, I will film a few issue spots on what my beliefs are about various issues. If I decide to run in the future, if I become a candidate in the future, you could use that as you may choose, okay? And then I never become a candidate. I decide against becoming a candidate, okay? At that point, it's clear, it's like a tree falling in a forest that nobody ever heard. It's insignificant in the future.
Right.
You're suggesting that if I become a candidate later on, the legal significance springs into existence almost retroactively.
Well, I'm...
And then that's my question is, how do I sort of bootstrap or assert jurisdiction retroactively over material or activity that I had very little jurisdiction over or none?
Right.
Given the decision not to run.
So, first of all, I'm here seeking an advisory opinion. So you all tell me, you all tell me whether it is or is not lawful to do that. That's actually what I'm asking. If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't have needed to come.
I'm asking for your legal views as a long-time practitioner.
The second is, I want to say, Commissioner Goodman, if you'd ever do run for the House or Senate, I would be happy to represent you. It would be a brave new expansion of my practice, but one that I would take on eagerly. The difference between the way you're framing it and the way I frame it is, I think you're framing that as a question under the jurisdiction for candidacy and testing the waters, and I view it as a question, and it is a question of the application of 109.21, the coordination, the conduct prong, the conduct prong, whether the conduct prong can be triggered for activity that took place before one was a candidate. That's really, if you, so it's not about, it's really not a, were they testing the waters at that time, were they not testing the waters at that time? It's just, if you have coordination, pre-candidacy, is that then, does that implicate the 109.21 conduct test? Mm-hmm. And I think it's an interesting question, and I think it's one worth asking, which is why House Majority PAC and Senate Majority PAC asked it, because there are a lot of House and Senate races for which this is a very live issue. You know, I realize that there is undoubtedly, because I read the newspaper, there is undoubtedly people who find this an interesting question at other levels. But in the House or Senate, where campaigns are not that set, there are candidates still considering getting into races. And House Majority PAC and Senate Majority PAC, if freed to do this, stand in a very, in a very important place as organizations. I think Senate Majority PAC may have been the second largest super PAC spender last cycle. House Majority PAC was a significant organization in spending. And if in fact there is no look back to that, whether it's testing the waters or not testing the waters, that's an important thing for us to know.
Thank you.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Can I try?
Try it. Whisper in.
I'll listen very carefully.
This is actually directed towards my colleague.
Oh, good.
I believe your premise is wrong. The testing the waters regulations do not extend the statute retroactively backward to a time or place where we otherwise wouldn't have jurisdiction. The testing the waters regulation is an exemption to what would otherwise be absolutely considered under the statute to be candidate activities. The commission decided many years ago that it would allow candidates a little bit of an opportunity to do a little traveling, to test their message, to see if they could raise some money, if they could have a viable candidacy. And what the commission did was to create this exemption, and it says quite clearly, first words under the Testing the Waters regulation are general exemption. It's an exemption to what the statute already covers. And what the commission said then was, while you are in this testing the waters phase, before you have decided to become a candidate, to throw your hat into the ring, the commission is not going to require you to file reports. But you have to track all of your contributions and expenditures, because should you decide to become a candidate, at that point, all of those contributions and expenditures will need to be reported. So the regulation doesn't read the statute backwards. The regulation provides a temporary exemption from reporting requirements for activity that is otherwise covered under the statute.
And if I can just, I'm sorry.
Please.
I wanted to amplify one thing. The other question I mentioned the one of the coordination question. The other one is the soft money question, as to whether or not if you have a circumstance where a pre-candidacy, again, setting aside the question of testing the waters or not, if you have pre-candidacy, which is why, by the way, we refer to them as a prospective candidate, right? Because this is someone who may be a candidate. If they participate in the formation of a super PAC, does that implicate the soft money prohibitions with respect to raising and spending money by that entity later? You know, that I don't think, again, has been addressed by the commission before. I asked a different question that was sort of in the same space, but didn't answer this question with respect to Aaron Bilbray in an AO that was, I'm pointing at Commissioner Walther only because he's from Nevada and she was from Nevada, not for any other reason, which had to do with whether someone who founded a 527 and ran for Congress, what could be that relationship. But the question of, if you have someone who forms or is involved in the establishment of a super PAC, what implication does that have for the super PAC's ongoing raising and spending of money? Does it trigger any part of the Part 300 restrictions? And again, these are novel questions, and they are questions that I think are very much alive right now in the House and Senate. And I think they're alive in the House and Senate on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. We came to the FEC because we think they're important for the FEC to resolve.
Any other, Commissioner Goodman, are you? You've got that look. No questions.
I want to use this constructively, Mr. Elias. We can discuss the assumption that you have jurisdiction to begin with over non-candidates in order to then have the government grant them an exemption. Some people question that first step, that analysis, but you had to assume jurisdiction in the first instance over a non-candidate to then define testing the waters as somehow an exemption from contribution expenditure. It's a bit of an existential question.
Well, it goes to the question of what's a candidate, when one becomes a candidate, because the statute talks about raising and spending money. And during the testing the waters phase, if nobody was raising or spending any money, they wouldn't even fall under the testing the waters exemption. They wouldn't be, you know, if somebody's just walking around their neighborhood saying, hey, you know, do you think you could support me if I ran for Congress? That doesn't fall under anything, because they're not raising or spending money, and that's what triggers our jurisdiction, is when people start raising and spending money. What the testing the waters exemption does is provide a little bit of space for people who are raising and spending money before they have to start reporting, so that they can gauge whether they think that their candidacy would have a chance and whether they really want to go all in on this. But it's all about the money.
Not all. It's also, because it's a two-prong test, you have to seek election. And if you're not seeking election yet, you haven't met the first prong of candidacy. The raising and spending of $5,000 is the second prong. So if you haven't made any commitment to run, you're not even sure if you're going to run, you haven't necessarily met the first prong. And there are all these objective standards we have on whether one has manifested the intent to run. So, but we don't need to resolve that here today for this purpose. I don't want to take up too much of Mr. Elias's time.
Okay, any other questions? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that we're not going to be voting on this matter today. That's what I'm told, but I just had a question. At this point, there are two drafts public, as you well know, and was wondering if you had an opportunity, Mr. Elias, to review those and if you had any comments or questions on those.
I did have an opportunity to review them.
Of course, mine was the best.
What?
Nothing.
I won't. I don't know who.
I'm
early. Several years ago, I made the mistake
of
commenting about a particular draft in mind with a particular commissioner. It didn't serve me well, so I don't do that anymore. I will assume that all six of you drafted both of them. I think that the two drafts are, as I read them, and I actually did a compare document, are substantially the same with respect to the first 10 or 9 or 10 questions.
Ten.
The last two questions that go to the agency and the event are different. I would say that. So I will start with the last two questions because that's where the difference is. I would say that if we have consensus among six commissioners on the first 10 questions, you will have done yourself, or 9 questions, you will have done yourself and the American public a great service. But focusing on the last two questions first, I think that on the agency question, it is not useful or constructive it's not useful or constructive to say that we can't know without a rulemaking. I mean, the truth is I have a right as an advisory opinion to ask under the rules we have. I mean, in some sense, it is a little bit of the same answer I gave Commissioner Goodman, telling me that the world should be other, the FEC's rules should be other than as they are, and I should seek an AO after you all have done a rulemaking is really telling me that I don't have a statutory right to a statutory right to an AO, which I do. So I don't agree with the agency answer in draft B. I think draft B, we aren't going to answer because Citizens United came along and maybe the rules are different. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. I'm not fully sure I understand why Citizens United would have affected the FEC's definition of agency. But honestly, if it did, maybe it made it more permissive. Maybe it made it more restrictive. I mean, honestly, the agency rulemaking, for those of you who are here, was not a kumbaya moment. I mean, many people, including several of my clients, sought a version of agency that was more permissive than the one that the FEC rested at. There were others who sought one that was more restrictive than the FEC rested at. And unless and until that rule is changed, which I mention that only because it strikes me as improbable that the six of you are going to find a place to move agency in light of all of the history and time that was spent coming up with the compromise, telling me that I don't get an answer because there needs to be a post-Citizens United rulemaking, I think is both practically wrong, and I think it's legally wrong. I think as a legal matter, I have a right to an advisory opinion under these regulations. I think the draft A probably gets the right answer, candidly. I think the commission has accepted a multiple hats theory for sons of candidates, for chiefs of staff of candidates who are chiefs of staff in congressional offices. It has ingrained the multiple hats theory, and to now say, well, maybe we don't actually mean any of that, unless there's a rulemaking, I think is wrong. And frankly, I'll just put my cards on the table. Absent you all telling me that the current precedent is not precedent, it is precedent. So I would hope the commission could come to 4 votes on that. On the last question of the size of event, my main disagreement with draft B is that it actually doesn't answer the question, right? The question we asked was, is there a minimum number of people? And the answer we get in draft A is no, there isn't a minimum number of people. The answer we get in B is two is too few. Well, that's great. I understand, too, as do you. That wasn't my question. So, should I walk away with that, believing that okay, the answer for draft B is three? Like what we asked was, is numerosity a factor? And if so, is there a minimum number? Draft A has the virtue of clarity. It says no, there's no minimum number. Okay, got it. We look at other indicia, and it's not based on whether it's five people or 10 people or four people or two people. Draft A, you know, again, draft B says, well, two is too few, but that actually wasn't the question. We mentioned two. We mentioned two, three, four, five as a inducement for you to tell us that if numerosity matters, that there is a minimum number that's too few, what is the minimum number? But just telling us two is not enough doesn't, then I guess I walk away from draft B thinking the answer is three. Because, you know, but I think draft A is in balance, is on balance on those two questions better than draft B. With respect to the other questions, like I said, I didn't see a huge material difference between them.
Well, you just made the mistake. No. let me say with respect, I mean, I take your point on the question relating to the number. And I think that's, of course, there is no clarity in the law with respect to that, and it's like the answers in some of the other responses, which is, you know, you have to sort of look at it dependent on the circumstances. But I take your point about, you know, the need for a little more clarity with respect to that. With regard to the other question about Super PAC, the ability of agents to do fundraising for and their own candidate, but for the super PAC that is for their own candidate, that is not addressed in the law. We do not have a rulemaking with respect to that issue about the scope of fundraising for super PACs. And so it seems to me that this comes squarely within what both the Act and the regulations require, which is that the Commission can't propose rules and new rules in an AO. It's quite clear that it has to be done through the rulemaking process if there are no rules that are applicable, such as the case in this instance. And, you know, I understand your frustration with respect to that problem, but we too often are using the AO process as if it's a rulemaking, which is inappropriate. I mean, the AO process should respond to the questions, yes, but only with regard to matters of law that we can make determinations about based on what the existing law is.
May I respond?
Sure, please. So I'm very interested in your.
I don't entirely disagree with you. However, I would note two things. One is that the advisory opinion process, and this is the 112.1, any person may request in writing an advisory opinion concerning the application of the Act. Right. So the absence of a rule doesn't mean that the agency can't grant an AO. So to the extent we are seeking, mm-hmm. we are seeking an advisory opinion under the Act, I don't think it's a very useful response to say, but we haven't done rules yet, because then you would have said you can only seek an AO under the rules, but not under the Act.
No, I understand. And I think in this case, neither of them is directly applicable.
No.
You absolutely, counsel has indicated that your request is appropriate request for an AO. I have no quarrel with that. I think that's absolutely true, and I do believe that you're entitled to the best we can do to give you advice with respect to the applicability of the Act and the rules. My view is just in this circumstance, and if you look at 112.4DF and 52 USC 30108B, we're not permitted to use rulemaking, to use AO processes as essentially rulemakings.
I guess the second point, though, that I would make is that we didn't ask the question. Maybe we could have. Maybe some would have liked us to, but we didn't ask the question whether candidates under the prior Senate Majority PAC, or then called Majority PAC, House Majority PAC AO, can solicit for super PACs. We asked a question about agency. And the agency rules, I don't think, are implicated one way or the other by whether it's post-Citizens United, pre-Citizens United. And I would caution, and, you know, I say this humbly and with respect to all of you, but for those of you who ideologically favor stricter adherence to the regulatory framework. That's not to suggest any of you are not in favor of the regulatory framework, but for those of you who tend to be more regulatory-minded, sending a message that because of Citizens United, I no longer need to pay attention to the existing agency rules, I would caution you, and it's why I started. My clients didn't support the existing agency rules. We thought they were too strict. There were others who thought that they were too loose. And if the message I walk away with is post-Citizens United, those agency rules are just a blank slate again, we will live to fight another day. And we will go back to apparent authority. We'll go back to a whole bunch of things that in the comments my clients filed comments on and others filed comments on that we lost in that rulemaking to actual authority. I'm sorry, not apparent authority. We wanted express authority. Remember, express implied versus actual apparent. We will go back to saying, well, blank slate, it's only express authority.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's not implied authority. So I think that the commission in the course of this should not cast doubt on the agency rules as a whole. And I think draft A does a nice job of basically saying these are the principles of agency and the FEC's agency rules and FEC agency advisory opinions, and we're going to stick with them. And so long answer to short question of what do I think of the two drafts, those would be my two comments.
And let me just, you know, respond to that, which is I was obviously not here for that debate, and I appreciate your comments, and I'll go back.
Yes.
Right. Thankfully, I wasn't, but from what it sounds like. But I will go back and take a look at it with that in mind. I appreciate the comment. Commissioner Weintraub.
I think your point is well taken. I think you're entitled to an answer to your questions. I regret that you had to come in an advisory opinion context and ask a lot of questions that I think would be better addressed through a rulemaking, should have been addressed through a rulemaking. We long ago should have done a rulemaking that would have addressed all of your questions and wouldn't have made it necessary for you to come in this context to ask these questions. I think that, you know, pretty much ever since Citizens United and since the advent of super PACs, I have been advocating within the building that we ought to do a rulemaking on how all of our rules, how the statute applies to super PACs, and whether any of our rules need to be amended in light of the advent of super PACs, because the facts on the ground have changed since we last did a number of rulemakings, notably coordination. I think we are derelict in our duty in not having done that. And I regret that I have never been able to convince my colleagues to engage in that effort. Earlier this year, I took another run at my colleagues, and I said, you know, on this testing the waters question, I said, it seems to me that there is a need for clarity out there, and that we would do a service to everyone out there if we could provide some guidance on what we believe the parameters of the testing the waters regulations are, and when somebody falls within that bucket and when they don't, and what they can and can't do. And I don't think there is something that is sort of a pre-testing the waters phase where somebody is experimenting with being a candidate, but they're not even testing the waters. That seemed to be a theory that was floated for a while, but I think people have backed off on that. But again, I could not get any buy-in on providing any kind of guidance on that, and I think that is regrettable. And it is also regrettable that we find ourselves frequently issuing advisory opinions that would be more appropriate for rulemakings, but that's what happens, because the statute does not require us to do rulemakings, even when it seems pretty apparent that we should, but it does require us to issue advisory opinions. So While I regret that we have not already answered all of your questions through a comprehensive rulemaking, I agree with you that you are entitled to answers. And I gather that we're not going to vote today, but try and come up with some that I'd be willing to support by the time we are voting, which I think will be at the next meeting.
May I inquire, maybe is procedurally not appropriate, so you can tell me no. If there are two drafts, and they are substantially similar on the majority of the questions, the reason for not voting is what? I mean, I've been in a lot of procedural postures at this table. I'm just trying to understand this.
I think the reason for not voting is because Dan Backer sent us a letter saying that we shouldn't because, no, I'm, because it came, yeah. I think my colleagues will have to respond to that. Are we ready to vote today? Mr. Vice Chair.
Well, I think the understanding, I think that it's been commission-wide, the understanding was that we wanted to schedule this this meeting because we knew what our kind of our outer limit for answering this question. I think that all advisory opinions are not necessarily created equal. They are entitled to the same statutory protection, but this one raises a number of very interesting, complex, and timely questions, and you've, as you have, and with many prior requests, you present a very meaty issue for the commission to consider, and we wanted to have this opportunity, and we all wanted to have at least one meeting. We had a little bit of a gap during the middle of the month because of, we had an FEC conference and so forth, so we knew that there was going to be some time off, but we wanted to make sure that there was at least one meeting where we could ask questions, one or more drafts be out there to ensure that, if there are some issues that need to get teased out beforehand, that we have kind of a buffer of a meeting so that the next time we can kind of put rubber to the road and answer the question definitively. That's the long and short.
I understand that and appreciate that. I just didn't have the back. I didn't have the backstory. So
yeah, I hope that provides a little bit of.
So I'm.
The next meeting is November 10th, which is the day.
Got it.
And so we will be deciding it for certain on that day, Commissioner Weintraub.
And just so you know, Mr. Elias, this one's for you. Just so you know, just because there are two drafts now that are substantially similar on 10 questions, I do not believe that you should automatically assume that that means there is consensus on the commission on those 10 answers.
Oh, I know that. Okay. That's not my first rodeo. I understand that drafts come up late. There will be, we could go up to G, F, F, G, H.
Anything could happen.
I got that. I didn't, in this instance, I could play out in my head different scenarios where different groups of commissioners might have drafted draft A or draft B, and I just didn't know, so I didn't want to presume that it was not it did not reflect the full range of views of the commissioners. But I understand that when before November 10th, it is impossible to know how many additional drafts will come out.
I personally do not know where some of my colleagues are on some of these questions, so. There's no way for you to know.
Right.
I think the only thing that I'm taking away, which is, which I think is important, is it does sound like I'm hearing from I hope all, that the questions will be answered.
If there are four votes, the questions
right.
will be answered.
No, but that there will be a substantive engagement by the commission on the questions.
Commissioner Walther.
Well, I'm not going to predict on that. I did want to say, though, that...
I think we're entitled to. And if here's why I'll put my cards on the table. I asked for a 30-day turn under the emergency. rules. For those of you who have followed me on Twitter, you know I was active when it took the commission 10 days to say, for the, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say the commission, the general counsel's office 10 days to deem the request complete without having asked a single clarifying question. Okay? If having been told it's not going to be 30 days and it's not going to be this meeting, it's going to be a later meeting, at the end of this rainbow is going to be a, we need a rulemaking, we're not answering your questions, or we're not sure in this question that you're a proper requester, like, then I think my clients have been done a great disservice, and which is why I singled out the rulemaking as an example. Like, if we're going to go, if the commission isn't going to engage in this, then the general counsel's office and I could have had that out at the front end. If you weren't going to engage in it, we could have done that in 30 days. If you think we need a rulemaking, tell me today. The fact is that the one way or another, the courts remain an avenue to ensure that the House and Senate campaigns do not go into this cycle, and House and Senate super PACs don't go into this cycle without any idea what these rules are. So I understand we may not get to four votes on everything, but if ultimately the commission is just going to throw its hands up and say this is all too hard and too complicated or too hypothetical or too whatever, like, tell me that today, because I don't think it would be appropriate. And like I said, there are other avenues of redress for us if that's the approach that the commission is going to take.
Appreciate your candor. Questions and your candor, but as Commissioner Weintraub indicated, I don't believe that any one of us actually knows what the consensus or the views are of others necessarily, so I don't think we're in a position to be able to tell you that today, and totally understood. I mean, for myself, you know what my views are because you know that draft B is my draft. So
now I do, after
now
I said
know.
Mean things
yes.
about it. So I've now failed at this
so
twice.
You know
next
that.
Time this
and
comes up in a hearing, I'm not saying which draft I like better.
Yeah, but I will promise you that we will come to a conclusion
On the 10th.
On the 10th. And if there's a delay and if there's any equivocation, I don't have any way of controlling that. Thank you. Is there anything further?
Yeah.
Commissioner Walter.
I was just going to go. I wanted to say a couple things. I agree that we should do a lot of these things by rulemaking, and we all have our own ideas on what those rules ought to be. And we could work on agency again, Mark, for another year or two and try and reach consensus. I mean, we did go through the ringer on that. But I think this is important enough where you're entitled to an opinion. I can see where the question might arise, well, we don't have law on the subject. Well, we have done enough, I think, to give an opinion. And I think also that, as you know, we've had some deadlocks recently. And I think that in response to that, some of us feel that to give a modicum of advice to the public, that we would not overly question whether or not there was a hypothetical whiff in some of the IO we received in the last few years. I think we've been willing to try and give an answer, even though maybe there was some hypothetical aspect to it, because we felt the need to give whatever input we could give on the subject for the public.
Yeah.
So that's my theory.
Let me just be clear. There is nothing hypothetical in this advisory opinion.
Okay.
Nothing at all. The Senate Majority PAC was the second largest spender in Senate campaigns last cycle, and you can look at its FEC reports on your fancy new website. It and House Majority PAC are both actively engaged in elections this cycle, and they are engaged in all of the activities that are permissible. Senate Majority PAC has sought three advisory opinions from this agency under now three different names, by the way, starting with Common Sense 10, then Majority PAC, then Senate Majority PAC. House Majority PAC joined Senate Majority PAC in the last one that dealt with members of Congress soliciting funds on their behalf and attending events, and that wasn't hypothetical. Members of Congress solicit funds within federal limits and attend events within the rules of the FEC. And likewise, if the rules are going to change now, not change. If the rules permit now a broader level of engagement than they had understood the case to be, then that's it. They'll engage. I mean, this is not going to be a situation. We are not asking hypothetically to allow, you know, Crossroads GPS to do it. We are asking, you know, because this is real. This is a live issue in House and Senate super PAC world.
Well, I was just laying my cards in the table. I agree with that.
All right. Is there anything further from the commission? Anything else you'd like to tell us, Mr. Elias?
No, you've got 14 minutes to prepare for Mr. Zolt.
Right. Thank you. Appreciate the clock. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'll see you on the 10th.
The 10th. Thank you.